This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African-American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a Black Left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. Coming up, Reverend Edward Pinckney speaks out from prison. George Zimmerman has nothing to fear from Eric Holder and the U.S. Justice Department. And why the Black community should be empowered to hire, fire, and oversee the police.
But first, the Federal Communications Commission last week came down firmly on the side of Internet neutrality. The FCC will designate the Internet as a public utility, subject to government regulation, and will prohibit the creation of fast and slow lanes of traffic on the net. Millions of citizens sent emails urging the FCC to protect the Internet. Kevin Zees is co-director of Popular Resistance, which mounted a direct action campaign to pressure the FCC.
Well, it's definitely a very big victory for freedom of speech on the Internet and no discrimination on the Internet. I mean, that's really what it boils down to. By reclassifying the Internet as a common carrier, it means that, like with any common carrier, a bus or whatever, there's no discrimination. Everybody has equal access. And that's what this debate is about. The Verizon and Comcast of the world wanted to begin charging websites different amounts of money to get better service. And that would have created a class system on the Internet. More inequality in this country. We don't need that. Keep the Internet equal and we'll be better off. And they wanted to start to charge for fast websites, and if you didn't pay for it, you get a slow website. And so that was what the battle was about. You know, there's interesting libertarian and Comcast propaganda out there that's talking about this being a government takeover of the Internet. That is such an exaggeration, and how this is going to threaten freedom on the Internet because the government's taken over. It's just the opposite. This is more like the First Amendment for the Internet, where people actually now have freedom of speech and equal access. And all they've taken over, if you want to call it that, is telling Comcast and Verizon, the corporations like them that bring the Internet to your house, that they can't discriminate. They bring it to the house, and that's all they do. They don't say which websites go faster or slower, which ones you can see and not see, how you can get on. They have to treat everybody equally. So that's what this is really about. It's an important victory. The other important victory at the FCC was lifting the bans on municipal broadband. This allows cities to develop their own Internet access for the people in their communities. A few cities have done this, and it's resulted in cheaper, less expensive service and faster Internet. In fact, the fastest Internet in the country are from those cities that have taken those steps. And there had been state laws that were blocking cities from doing that, and the FCC ruled that their power to control the communications in the United States circumvents those state laws, and so now municipalities are free to create their own Internet, which would be great because we do need competition. You know, we need competition with Comcast and Verizon. I think municipal broadband is a great way to have competition.
Wheeler, the Democratic chairman of the FCC, was behaving as if he was so happy with this net neutrality ruling. But, of course, initially he was one of the enemies of net neutrality and proposing something quite different.
Tom Wheeler initially proposed a tiered Internet, which was doing exactly what Comcast wanted, allow them to charge different fees for different, you know, different speeds and make an unequal Internet where the wealthy had speed and everyone else, like us, had slow websites. One of the methods of victory in any kind of political debate is for the opposition to do what's called a victorious retreat. What that means is they say, oh, I always wanted equality. I always wanted net neutrality. This, you know, I was always on your side. Of course, we had to occupy the FCC 10 months ago for a week to force this into people's anger. We had to generate interest and excitement so that millions of people commented. We had to show enough visibility and action on this so that people like John Oliver did a monologue on HBO. There were protests at Obama fundraisers. There were all over the country protests. There were protests at the White House. And, of course, we blockaded Tom Wheeler's driveway, preventing him going from work in his car. He was forced to take a common carrier to work. It was a metro, you know. So he was not, you know, with us from the beginning, and we had to push him to get to the right side. And know, it's so interesting. When you look back at the history of anything, it's always the elites who decided. So this will go down in history as President Obama and Tom Mueller. But what reality it was millions of people saying they want a free and fair and equal internet. And that's really what it was. People mobilized and organized and made it happen. And that was critical. We had to even go to the point of disrupting FCC hearings three times. The third time, we actually were tackled by their police, and we tried to hold the banner up when the Republican commission was speaking. The banner said 85% of Republicans support net neutrality, and we were tackled as we tried to hold that up. They threatened us with being charged with assault on a police officer. And at yesterday's hearing, when we were going in to enjoy our victory, we were banned from the building. The security said that we were a threat to the building's security. Not to the police, but to, anyway, a threat to the security of the building. So we weren't able to go in and see the victory.
There's no doubt that you and other grassroots activists did fantastic work in mobilizing millions of people to make their feelings on net neutrality known. But in some ways, this was still a battle of elites in that there were multi-billion dollar corporations involved in the internet on both sides.
Yes, that was interesting. And, you know, when you go into a campaign like this, you have to look at the power structure that's affected by the campaign. So, of course, we did look at which corporations could be pulled to our side and even move from being quiet to being actually speaking for us, speaking our views. And so that was not an accident that corporations came out and spoke. The movement, which is a really great coalition of a wide variety of groups, organized that. We had some tech lawyers who had contacts with those groups. We had people who had advised those groups. So we had, you know, all sorts of ways to get access to them and let them know that we wanted them to speak out on this. And so, yes, it was a battle of the corporations, partially, and the people versus, you know, a handful of broadband providers like Comcast and Verizon. But that's part of the process. We were lucky that we had the ability to bring those corporations to our side and get them involved. And that makes a difference. You can divide the corporate power structure. That certainly makes it much easier to win these things. You see the same thing in the TPP, by the way, because the TPP and these other trade agreements, they support the big transnational corporations. They don't support the small and medium-sized business people. They don't support the new startups, the entrepreneurs. They, in fact, make it harder for those groups to get going. So even with this other issue of the, you know, the trade agreements, there's divisions we can also build. And I think that's often true. And too often, the advocates don't really recognize the ability to divide the corporate power structure and bring people to our side to make it much more complicated for people in the Senate and the House, not knowing which side of the corporation they should be on.
The United States is, of course, the birthplace of the internet, and the United States constantly brags about its technical superiority. But how does the U.S. really rate in terms of internet service and access and the quality of service to the people?
Terribly. We are well down the list, something like of the developed nations in like the 40th ranking or so, depending on how you rank them. But we pay the highest prices, have the slowest speeds. We don't provide internet to all classes of people in this country. We don't provide internet to rural areas. We have a long way to go to really create the democratized internet that we need. And so we have a lot of work to do to continue to improve that. I think net neutrality will help with that, particularly with the municipal broadband ability now to compete. But we have to advocate for all those kinds of changes to continue building the democratic internet. And not only that, we have to start to use the democratic internet more effectively. I mean, we've always seen the beginnings of people working together to consciously get the word out on various issues. For example, on the Trans-Pacific Partnership, there's been virtually zero media coverage in the corporate network news, very little on the cable network news. And so we've been educating people through the internet, through our own social media, through independent media. And that is what we have to build stronger. I think if we consciously work together to overcome the corporate media, we have a tool to do it now with a net neutral internet. And so I think all advocacy groups need to figure out tactics that can bring people together to consciously overcome the corporate media and make the people the media. And I think that's a very exciting potential for the future that could have a big impact on lots of issues.
That was Kevin Zees of Popular Resistance speaking from Baltimore.
The Black is Back Coalition for Social Justice, Peace, and Reparations has issued a call for Black community control of police as a right of self-determination. Black is Back chairman Omali Yeshitela says the emphasis is on black community control.
I think it's extremely important to recognize that black people in this country suffer from a peculiar situation that has been imposed on us for a very, very long time, and that we were captured, brought into captivity and have existed under a system as a people. We've suffered a kind of domestic colonization in this country, and there's a way that people like to muddle that issue, and they like to talk about the people in general terms and progress for the people in general without recognizing the specific features of the oppression of black people in this country. I think that when we talk about black community control of the police, we're also recognizing the fact that it was a black 12-year-old Tamir Rice that was gunned down in Cleveland. It was a black Eric Garner. It was a black Mike Brown. And is a black Von Derrick Myers, and all around this country, the conditions that we suffer from as a people, where some folk have suggested that every 28 hours or so, at least one African is killed by some policeman or something with a relationship to the police. So we don't want to muddle this question up, and we think it's important because you can talk about community control of the police in a fashion that, again, liquidates the fact that black people are the primary or a primary target of this police organization. And it gives the impression of being progressive because we talk about the people in general, but the people in general are not suffering police violence. Black people are certainly, and Mexican people are certainly, and there are other subject and colonized people within these borders that are. But most times when people talk about general conditions, they try to generalize the situation. It's a means that they want to use to liquidate the colonial contradiction that black people experience in this country.
So when we talk about the police being an army of occupation, we're speaking of their behavior and purpose in the black community, not everywhere.
Not everywhere. And I think it's important to understand that one of the really necessary things for people to begin grappling with today, especially as so many people have been thrust into political life, political motion, rather abruptly and recently, subsequent to the murder of Mike Brown on August 9th of 2014 and the tremendous resistance that's come out of that. People have been thrust into political life, and people are in various places throughout this country. Even as recently that I was aware of last week someplace, people are blocking highways and things like that, and police organizations throughout this country are having their little meetings to try and show how they are really wonderful and they love black people. The question that is before us is, where the hell do the police come from? Is this a natural situation that there are cops in all of our communities? Is this something that's absolutely necessary? And we did the Black People's Grand Jury as part of the coalition in Ferguson just a few weeks ago. And one of the persons that testified was a former chief of police, an African, a black man who's a former chief of police. And he made the statement that if there were no police, there would be chaos in the streets, etc. And I don't think that's the case. I think that the police is not an entity that's prevented to stop chaos in general, but I think it's an entity that is an arm of a particular organization that has a particular role in history, and that is to preserve more or less the class peace and to protect the interests of whatever ruling class that's in power. And in this country, we have a ruling class that's come to power through slavery, through the theft of whole land mass that results in concentration camps called Indian reservations in this country up to now, through colonialism. And so the state, the whole state that's here to preserve order and to maintain this ruling class, it is protecting that system. And from its genesis, from its very birth, it was an anti-black, anti-Indian, anti-Mexican entity. And I think it's important for us to understand that the police is an arm of the state. And the state is without conscience. It doesn't have conscience. It doesn't do what it does because it is culturally insensitive. It doesn't do what it does because there are no cameras around or anything like that. It does what it does in order to protect the status quo based on slavery and based on colonialism and based on stolen land and false borders and a profit system that cannot tolerate those from whom it extracts all this value and profit standing up and challenging the monopoly of power and resources in the hand of a particular white ruling class.
The document makes a contrast between what we've come to know as police review boards and what you envision as black community control of police. What's the distinction?
I think the distinction is that the things that they talk about in terms of police review boards and the other liberal reforms of that sort that's been put forward, and they are designed primarily to reform the system. They don't challenge the system. And the consequence of this reform is not to empower the people in it at all. It simply pretends to offer power to the people by suggesting that the people can review what the state has done after it has done it. What we're saying is that the police is an arm of the state, and that a democracy for black people implies placing limitations on the ability of the state in the form of the police and other organizations, prisons, courts, etc., to impose its will in our community. And so what has to happen is that we have to initiate, when we talk about reform, the need to contribute to the deconstruction of this relationship. And that means that black people ourselves need the democratic right, must demand the democratic right for control of these armed forces in our communities. We need to have the ability to hire, fire, train, set standards for behavior, be able to fund, defund the activities of this, and then establish what the role of this force is in the community, so it is no longer an outside community invading the community, but it becomes a part of the very fabric of the community itself. That is the highest expression of democracy that we can find. So anybody who really talks about they really want some kind of meaningful reform, and this is a real difficult and complex question with the police and the quote-unquote minorities, we're saying that it's really not that complex. That what you can do is make a situation where the people who are affected by the situation have control ourselves over this instrument, and I guarantee you that we will not be murdering ourselves in the streets as this invading force. And we're saying that there is a opportunism, which is the tendency to sacrifice the long-term interests of the people for a short-term advantage for a sector of the population, is what informs demands like police review boards and just get body cameras and things like that, that seeks to perfect the system as opposed to changing the relationship that we have to the system. And when we say opportunism, we've been in this place for such a long time that some people will think you're simply name-calling, but it's not a matter of name-calling. It's trying to establish some kind of science in this situation to say that it's not just a matter of different people with different opinions, that one road leads to actually empowering a community that suffers from a lack of power, and then the other road leads to perfecting the process through which a hostile entity imposes its power on our community. Opportunism has to go, and it means that it gives us, it arms people with the information and the science to be able to distinguish Al Sharpton or Holder or Barack Hussein Obama, who are the ones who are promoting this notion, as well as CNN and various other media, that it can be resolved, this relationship between our community and the police, by simply having review boards and more cameras and sensitivity training and such as that.
You're talking about the community being able to hire and fire and set policy. Those are the kinds of demands that we associated with demands for community control of schools. And some of those community-controlled school boards actually did come into effect in some places at some periods in time. If we can control the schools through community board bases, why not the police?
Why not the police? And of course, if you remember, even those struggles around community control of schools, there were fierce battles associated with that, and all kinds of interests got involved and did everything to undermine that, to undermine the demand for community control of schools, and did everything they could to crush it. And in most instances, people don't even remember the notion of community control of schools that's been so successful in pushing it out off the agenda inside this country. Well, we have to resurrect this demand for black community control of the police. We must demand that. We must say that we want to be free, that the problem that we have didn't start on August 9th, 2014 with the police. It didn't start with Eric Garner, etc. It's a whole comprehensive contradiction that responds to the fact that black people do not have power over our lives as a people, as a group, and that the part of the struggle that we have to be involved in is taking that power. And I said taking it because nobody's going to give you the power. It has to be something that we take as a people. And if you look at it, we can't be trapped with this view that somehow the police, that's the only problem. It's not a coincidence that the police involved in murdering the same group of people that also find themselves victims of mass incarceration, victims of incredible kinds of terror and brutality in the school system, victims of unemployment, victims of the worst kind of housing, that all of that is a consequence of having lost the right to be a self-determining people. And when we move forward on any question, it's absolutely necessary for us to do so in pursuit of the power to control our own lives. And that's why we say black community control of the police. Not because we think that this is the final solution, but it is something that moves us toward deconstructing this relationship that we have with a hostile state that has brought us into this association at gunpoint.
And the color of the police and the color of the police chief is not really key in this debate.
It's not key. It's not key. That's why we saw in New Jersey where the Negro cop stopped the car. He was with a white cop and literally told the guy he was going to execute him and shot him on video. And the chief of police in Philadelphia, when they dropped the bomb in 1985, was an African, and the mayor was an African. So that's not the fundamental question, the color. If we control the policies, we can even have a white cop or some white cops. If we control the ability to punish, to say that people who victimize our people will pay a consequence, then I guarantee you we'll have much less need to deliver a consequence because the power will be the determining factor in this relationship.
And one of the phrases in the document says that black community control of the police would give our people the opportunity to require police to become one with the people.
Become one with the people. Because as it is, we have a police organization that comes to our community as outsiders. It's really worth considering the fact that the police come to our community looking for trouble. They call it crime. But that's the only reason they come to the community looking for trouble. So if there are three black men walking down the street, especially if they're young, that's the possible trouble. And if they're in the community at a certain hour, that's a possible trouble. If they're standing out from a sandwich shop despite the fact they just bought a sandwich, that's possible trouble. If they're walking in the middle of the street, and even though there's no traffic, even though it's that kind of community where it's not abnormal for people to be walking in the middle of the street in that kind of housing project, that's trouble that the police are looking for, and people die as a consequence of that. So we're saying we need, this entity has to be a part of the community itself, a part of the fabric of the community, one with the community that's not just looking for trouble, but is engaged with the community in solving all the problems of the community. And they are profound. And crime is a problem, but it is only a problem because of many of the other contradictions that our community suffers from. So we want an entity that is not in the hands of an outside force that comes there looking to serve the interests of an outside force, but is a product of our community that's here to serve the interests of this community and help to solve the problems that we recognize in the community as problems.
Omali Yeshetela of the Black Is Back Coalition, speaking from St. Petersburg, Florida.
The U.S. Justice Department has finally let it be known that no charges of any kind will be brought against George Zimmerman. The Sanford, Florida vigilante who killed Trayvon Martin 3 years ago. Zimmerman was later acquitted of murder charges by a nearly all-white jury. What does that say about the U.S. criminal justice system? We asked Carl Dix of the Stop Mass Incarceration Network.
Well, it says that we're dealing with a criminal injustice system, and one that works to keep people caught up in the injustice that they bring down. Because if you go back to when Zimmerman walked, we were told that, well, don't worry, the feds are going to come in, which is what they tell us every time there's a significant case like that. The feds are held out as that dangling thing that'll give you justice after you've just been punched in the gut by the local cops, and then the DAs and the courts refuse to punish brutal murdering cops. It's held out there for you that, well, the feds will come in. That's been done very big over the past few months when people were outraged around the murders of Michael Brown and Eric Garner and the fact that those cops walked. Well, this is an indication of what the U.S. Department of Justice is for. It is to keep people thinking that there's somewhere in the system that you can find justice. And what I have been doing with folks since they came down with this piece on Trayvon is saying, let's go back to Malcolm. He told us that the federal foxes cannot be relied on to deal with the injustice that the local wolves are bringing down on you. That was 50 years ago he was telling us that, and it rings just as true today.
Well, this time they dangled for a couple of years. Why did they feel compelled to dangle this threat to do something that they clearly were not prepared to do for such a long time?
Well, they'll have to say exactly why. I mean, it usually is about a year or longer that these federal investigations take, because the feds have done hundreds of investigations on police murders, particularly brutal things that police have done to black and Latino people. And they usually spend at least a year before they come back and tell you we ain't doing nothing, which is almost always what they come back to. And we can again look historically on this, because the federal government never did anything in the thousands of lynchings that went down. There was never a federal prosecution brought around the lynchings of black people that went on from the late 1800s up to the 1950s and 60s. Well, if we look since then, the feds have done hundreds of investigations of police murders and other things, and they have almost never brought any prosecutions against the cops or the racist vigilantes who perpetrated those crimes. Almost never, and they've never charged a cop for murder, you know, on the federal level. But they've almost never charged cops with anything that was done to black people. So this is par for the course for the Department of Justice. They stretch it out. They hope that people have forgotten about the horrific crime that the system carried out. And then after they've got a good enough interval, then they come back with, we ain't doing nothing on this level either. The problem for them right now is that while this is a decent interval since Trayvon's murder, it happens in the wake of and in the midst of the continuing wave of murders by police and a few racist vigilantes thrown in. So the decent interval thing is not going to work this time. And it really does challenge people to get back out in the streets. I mean, we cannot accept this and suffer this in silence. It is not enough to have stood up the end of last year and say, well, we got them the message, now they're going to do something. They're telling you again, if you thought they were going to do something, not to expect that. They have even floated out trial balloons around Michael Brown's murder that they're not going to do anything without having made an official decision. So it's time to wake up to the reality and see to it that it is on us to deal with this. And I will tell you, it will take revolution, nothing less, to end horrors like the murder of Trayvon by the racist vigilante Zimmerman, as well as the continuing murders of Black and Latino people by police, and that it is going to take right now people standing up, taking to the streets, and saying this must stop, and meaning it. And that's why the Stop Mass Incarceration Network has been involved in calling for April 14th to be a day of disrupting business as usual nationwide all across this country. No school, no work, in the streets delivering a message that we will accept this no more. Police murder, murder by racist vigilantes must stop.
This decent interval that you talked about seems more like an indecent interval. Under the elder George Bush, the Justice Department did bring civil rights charges against cops in the Rodney King case, but apparently the Obama administration can't even measure up to the standards of the first Bush administration.
Well, what we're supposed to get is the sight of a Black man in the White House and a Black man running the Department of Justice is supposed to be enough. That's supposed to keep us going. And Eric Holder is doing his tour talking about bringing the community and the police back together. He's gone to different cities to talk about that. The head of the FBI talking about improving relations between the police and community. And see, that is not what we need. We don't need to improve relations. We need to stop the police from getting away with murdering people. That's what's needed. You know, don't tell me we need some sensitivity training. What kind of training does it take to not murder somebody? I watched the video of Eric Garner. I heard him tell those cops, "I can't breathe," again and again and again. And they kept twisting his neck, cutting off his windpipe, kneeling into his back. They kept choking him to death, even as he cried out that he couldn't breathe. That is not a lack of training. That is cops out there who know what their role is, and it's to brutalize and murder Black and Latino people, to keep us in line, to keep us down, and subjected to the oppression and exploitation the system brings down. And we have to stand up and say, we're not going to take it anymore. April 14th is going to be a day of doing that, and I encourage everybody to be a part of that. Wherever you are, wherever you're coming from, if you think it is a horrific crime for the police to get away with murder, then you need to stand up and say it's got to stop. And April 14th is the day to do that. You can go to the website stopmassincarceration.net. Stop Mass Incarceration Network has just put up a statement around the Justice Department giving the final pass to the racist murdering vigilante Zimmerman. And it's got a lot of information about how you can get involved in April 14th. You could also go to the website revcom.us.
That was Carl Dix of the Stop Mass Incarceration Network in New York City.
Trayvon Martin and his hoodie came to symbolize that Black lives don't matter much to the people who rule the United States. Columbia, South Carolina activist Kevin Alexander Gray is editor of the book Killing Trayvons, an anthology of American violence. Gray is preparing to attend the celebration of the 50th anniversary of the Selma, Alabama Voting Rights March. It's also been 50 years since Malcolm X was assassinated. And today, in the waning years of Barack Obama's presidency, we see the emergence of a national Black Lives Matter mobilization. We asked Kevin Alexander Gray if we're seeing a return to mass movement politics after two generations of dormancy.
Well, you know, movements are about organizing. Selma was about organizing. Malcolm was about organizing. When Dr. King was assassinated, he was about organizing. So if we're going to have a movement, it takes people figuring out the context of their lives, the context of imperialism and what that means even on the local level as it relates to police power, what it means on the international level as it relates to who has to go to war and who dies and who gets the benefit of that. So I think people are coming to a realization that there are some things that need to happen in this country. If the country is going to survive as a country, if the country is going to survive and evolve into what it claims it already is. So in that respect, if young folk are taking an interest in Selma, are taking an interest in doing what young folk do, and that's being fuel for movements, I'm going to be optimistic and hope that that's one of the things that this commemoration reinforces. And I'm hoping to see young folk there. Generally, I don't go to commemorative events because, you know, there's so much stuff that have to be done in the here and now. But Selma, Ferguson, Oakland, New York, Detroit, Chicago, Sanford, Atlanta, Gaza, the Left Bank, you know, all around this world, there's a need for people to take on power and change the course of the world from being such a violent place. And so, you know, I'm going to go in that spirit.
Selma was about voting rights, and Dr. King was organizing for a movement directed at poverty and for jobs. And in the 80s, there was a movement to change U.S. policy in South Africa. But this movement is a focus on police. How does that make it different, or does it?
Well, you know, the police do represent government. The police represent the power of the state, trying to keep people in their place, trying to keep people poor and paying into the system for fines, for court appearances. The police are about introducing people into a criminal justice system to where they're tracked all their lives. It's about making people cower to power. So, you know, if people are taking it on at that level, that's just one level. But then again, you get into grand jury reform, the war on drugs, and where do we go with legalization, the private prison industry, the militarization of the police departments, the militarization of our nation. So it's a place to begin to place the effects of imperialism into context.
So here we have young black people taking on the cops, taking on the state, and it occurs at a moment in history when the state, at least at the federal level, has been personified by a black man, Barack Obama.
Well, you know, he's still the Fed. I don't know if these kids didn't know about that. He's always represented the government and the status quo, and he's always represented Wall Street, and everything that he's about is about privatization, even privatization of their misery, be it through health care or through the private prison systems or through charter schools or through now this idea of raiding colleges and the attack on HBCUs or changing the loan criteria for parents wanting to get loans to send their kids to school, not having an effective response to the housing crises in the black community, which has destroyed credit and wealth in the black community in this term, not having an answer to black unemployment, using the old Reagan bromide of trickle-down economics. So everything as it relates to the black community and this president has been an utter and absolute disaster to having black people support endless wars, support this idea of assassination. He's been an absolute and utter disaster for the black community and them surrendering any kind of political demand just so that there wasn't the illusion that he was a failure. He has been an absolute disaster for black people.
If this movement or mobilization can sustain itself, keep up the momentum, what does that augur in terms of this upcoming presidential contest for 2016, a presidential contest in the presence of a movement, something we haven't seen in two generations?
Well, look, Chicago is indicative, and the runoff between Rahm Emanuel and Alderman Garcia, that's interesting because that is the teachers' union and O-line Harold Washington coalition politics taking place, and those were progressive politics. And so maybe that's a signal, but people are going to, for a while, be swept up by the whole idea of the Hillary Clinton inevitability game that the mainstream media is going to play. And in the absence of having anything, people are going to feel on the national level that's where the money's going to be and where the effort's going to be. You'll see that. But I'm hoping that the young folk who are organizing about police power and what's wrong with this criminal justice system, I hope they can look beyond that and realize that a lot of what they have to do is on the local level, is going to those meetings and changing policy and demanding that we have citizens review boards with the power to subpoena witnesses and the power to send indictments to the grand jury. We have to insist in some respects that some police departments be disbanded or at the very least come up for some kind of review by the Justice Department. We have to demand that the nature of plea bargains and how prosecutors misuse plea bargains be changed in some kind of way. We have to have an end to private prison. So that means getting involved with these state legislatures and marching and putting pressure on people where they live. That's the local aspect of what people have to do. But as far as national politics, I mean, what are our options? We don't have anything approximating a Podemos or Syriza here in this country. The Green Party and Jill Stein, if they accept and take on some of the issues of the young folk in a meaningful way, well, maybe they'll get a hearing. But that goes back to organizing and whether or not the only third-party force in the country or something that represents the carnival force would be the Green Party. But if you're talking about whether or not people are going to abandon the Democratic Party for the sake of allowing a Scott Walker or Chris Christie's out of it or a Mike Huckabee or any of these other lunatics from the Republican Party to be president. Not that there's a difference between a neoliberal and a neoconservative, between a Hillary Clinton, a Jeb Bush, or even a Scott Walker. But I think that people will think that there is a difference, and then they're going to get, on the national level, they'll get swept up in every 4 years in this country, and they'll go with frick or frack.
Well, maybe the promise of a movement is that it makes people think differently about political parties, and maybe a real political party could arise from a larger and broader and more energetic movement.
That's a hope, but I don't know if you can build a movement. I mean, you're talking about a movement, and movements do take a little bit of time because you really have to work to change people's consciousness on a lot of different levels. You have to work to have a mechanism to educate people or help them to educate themselves as to the necessity of politics and what a different kind of politic can bring. You have to persuade them of a different type of reality. And so, given the resources that we don't have, we have people power to some degree, but there's still that on-the-ground organizing and educating that we have to do in the face of what you're bombarded with through national and mainstream media. I don't think it's going to be built overnight. I do think a movement's emerging. But the politics of Black Lives Matter and what's going on in police departments and the fact that the wealth gap is just growing so wide that people are suffering and they're starting to talk about their suffering, that could cause some things to happen, at least some things to be rhetorically expressed in these presidential campaigns. But as far as the movement to change them structurally, I just think this is going to take a little bit longer than 2 or 3 years.
Well, certainly if lots of black people have become disenchanted with Obama, a black president, this would indicate that nobody's going to get all enamored and in awe of Hillary Clinton.
And maybe they'll remember at one point in time they were mad at Hill and Bill Clinton because Bill showed who he really is when his wife was running against Obama. Maybe they'll remember that they stopped loving the Clintons, but then again, maybe it's like the old saying in politics, you know, they love you, they stop loving you, and then they start loving you again. Politics is just that cold. The fact that they loved Obama, who was always so weak ideologically, leaves room for them to love Hill and Hillary Clinton because they think they kind of love Bill because at one time they did consider him a soul brother. People are confused that way.
Kevin Alexander Gray in Columbia, South Carolina.
Reverend Edward Pinckney is speaking out from behind prison bars. The 66-year-old activist was sentenced to 2.5 to 10 years in prison on charges of tampering with an election recall petition in Benton Harbor, Michigan, a mostly black town dominated by the giant Whirlpool Corporation. Reverend Pinckney has always maintained that Whirlpool controls the cops and the courts in the county. He's serving time on the other side of Michigan at the state prison in Marquette.
I just want people to know that we must hold all elected officials, judges, and everybody else accountable for their action and their inaction. It is crucial that we take a stand because in Barron County, Michigan, they have one job. That's to send every single person to prison, eliminate them by putting them on probation or by sending them to prison So we have a special obligation. See, in the 60s, it was called Negro removal. In Bosnia, it was called ethnic cleansing. Today, it's called genocide. That is exactly what's happening, not only in Barron County, Benton, Upper Michigan, but around the country. So we, the people, must take a stand and say enough is enough and take charge of our actions, because we have to learn to work together. It doesn't make a difference whether you're black, white, yellow, brown, whatever it is. We must come together and fight this thing before it overtakes us, because if, as an individual, they will attempt to crush you. So let's work together and get this thing right.
Reverend Edward Pinckney, speaking from the Michigan State Prison at Marquette.
Reverend Pinckney was interviewed by Prison Radio, based in Pennsylvania, where the state legislature has passed a bill aimed at silencing the voices of prison inmates, especially Mumia Abu-Jamal, the nation's best-known political prisoner. This week, we're presenting two more reports from Prison Radio. Kerry Shakabuna Marshall has served 25 years of a life sentence that was handed down when he was still a juvenile. He's locked up at the state prison in Rockview, Pennsylvania. Marshall is a founding member of the Human Rights Coalition and editor of The Movement magazine. He filed this report on the police killing of a transgender teenager in Denver, Colorado.
Jessica Hernandez, a 17-year-old transgender Latina known as Jessie to her friends, was murdered in cold blood by two Denver, Colorado police officers while sitting in a vehicle with four of her teenage friends. Denver police claimed they received a call about a suspicious car sitting idle on a street alley. Two unmarked police cars boxed Jessica's vehicles in the alley from the front and back. One of the cops approached Jesse's vehicles and fired three shots from his handgun into the vehicle. All three shots struck Jessie, the driver of the vehicle, rendering her unconscious and possibly dead. The police officer immediately snatched Jessie's unconscious limp body from the vehicle, slammed her body to the ground, and smashing her nose in the process, and handcuffed her. Jessie was probably dead before the cops snatched her from the vehicle. The mother of Jessie came to the scene of the crime just in time to witness the paramedics crew mishandle her child's body by dragging Jessie's body on the ground and thrown onto a gurney like a dead animal. Paramedics showed no respect for Jessie's body, not one bit. Unbeknownst to the killer cops, Jessie was well known and respected within the LGBT community. And as a transgender teenage boy, over 800 people attended Jessie's funeral to pay their respects. The Latino and black community in the city of Denver protested and demanded justice for Jessie. The two killer cops were put on administrative leave by the Denver Police Department in an attempt to calm the people's anger against them. Why justice for Jessie? Some people may ask, because Jessie, like the murder of unarmed teen Michael Brown in Ferguson, Missouri, was yet another unarmed teenage Latino that has been blatantly murdered by two white cops whom appears to possess a total disregard for Latino and African lives. Because Jessie was a transgender whom cops seem to target and mistreat. Because Jessie was unarmed. And how about because Jessie was a fellow human being whose life matters? The powers that be are going to claim that the two Denver killer cops are just bad apples and the system works fine. But try telling that nonsense to Jessie, her mother, or to the approximately 90 million African and Latino citizens of America. They would more than likely tell them that it isn't a few bad apples in the system that needs to be thrown away, but that the whole damn rotten system is the problem and must be thrown out. This is why we demand justice for Jessie.
The cops claim that Jessica Hernandez tried to run them over.
Kenneth E. Hartman has served 35 years of a sentence of life without the possibility of parole in California for the death of a man in a drunken fistfight when he was 19 years old. Hartman has become an author in prison and is executive director of the Other Death Penalty Project. He filed this report on the dark side of American exceptionalism for Prison Radio.
This country likes to pride itself on its exceptionalism, on how America is the shining city on the hill, on how this is man's last best hope. This sentiment swells our hearts with pride and, sadly, clouds our judgment and our vision. There is, in fact, a dark side to our exceptionalism, and we who live inside the prison industrial complex as many outposts know all about it. From the outset of the Republic, there has existed a strong mean streak, a desire to punish and inflict pain. Before the Articles of Confederation first united the original 13 colonies, the first prison opened in an abandoned copper mine in Connecticut. Not surprisingly, the first prison riot happened in that same copper mine not much later. As the years progressed and the country grew, our prison systems also grew, outpacing the growth of the population, outpacing any rationale but the satisfying of that punitive, exceptionally American impulse. After the Civil War, with the toppling of the South's system of oppression, not to mention much of the rest of the country, passage of the 13th Amendment ensured that slavery and involuntary servitude were abolished, except as a punishment for crime. That last clause doesn't get much coverage in history books, but it's crucial to understanding the modern prison state. Having been convicted of a crime, a whole panoply of bad outcomes could be poured down on the head of the convict. We've been rented out to till the fields and harvest the crops, chained together to clean the streets, and compelled to work in factories making everything from license plates to body armor and combat helmets. We've been used to break strikes, drive down wages, and throw any number of other monkey wrenches into the labor market. To this day, in fact, prisoners do all manner of dirty, dangerous, and otherwise undesirable jobs for little to no pay. Here in California, the Attorney General's office and the governor argued against applying extra time credits to nonviolent low-level prisoners because they were needed to man the fire lines in our tinder-dry forests. And they save a lot of money, too. In the so-called progressive era of the early 20th century, prison reformers concocted mad experiments that were supposed to deter prisoners from future criminality. The Auburn system was implemented where prisoners were kept in complete isolation from one another so as to prevent contamination of thinking. Only after costs spiraled and the need for products became evident was this practice ended. The fact that numerous prisoners went insane was also noted as a problem. Of course, how we got to today, with the highest incarceration rate in the world, the longest sentences served in the world, and the biggest, most expensive prison system ever in the history of the world, that's a story of politics and fear. Conservative politicians, seizing on the fears of the white middle class, trumpeted the war on crime as the antidote. Pretty fast, the numerous entities that make up the prison industrial complex, the construction companies that build prisons, the suppliers, the public employee unions of guards and others, the private prison companies that lease out cells, all teamed up with the demagogues, Republicans first, but Democrats no less, to convince the public of the desperate need to imprison more and more of their neighbors, particularly if their neighbors lived in the defunded and denuded inner cities. Why does this matter? Because it's hard to know where to go if you don't know where you've been. And because all of this remains largely unknown, even to prison reform activists, even to prisoners. There is a reason why American prisons are the worst in the industrialized world. It's a product of our history creating our present-day reality. For a couple of very revealing accounts of the truth of how prison could be run, check out Susan Olasek's fantastic blog entries from when she toured Scandinavian prisons in the Enneagram Prison Project's website, or read Professor Doran Larson's excellent article, Why Scandinavian Prisons Are Superior, on the Atlantic's website. Did you know that Canada has a National Prisoners' Day? Or that during the holidays in Europe, the prisons mostly empty out because the prisoners mostly go home to celebrate with their families? How about that in many prison systems, prisoners are issued a cell phone to stay in contact with their friends and families? that being forced to wear a uniform is frowned on in many places and forbidden as demeaning in some. I've had the same basic conversation with activists for years now. It goes something like this. We can't ask for too much because the public's not ready for it. This applies to everything from life without parole sentences to more humane visiting policies. I always say the same thing. It might be too much for the loud, angry haters, and it might be too much for the profiteers and the supporters of the prison industrial complex, but they are not the majority. It really is past time for all of us trying to fix this mess, to stop kowtowing, and start standing up to power. People on all sides of the political spectrum are, finally, coming out in favor of big change to the prisons. What are we waiting for? Part of our exceptionalist myth has always been that we are the home of the brave. It's time to be brave.
That was Kenneth E. Hartman, serving life without the possibility of parole in California.
The Guardian newspaper last week reported that the Chicago Police Department operates a secret facility where prisoners are made to disappear while they are interrogated, hidden from family and lawyers. The revelation coincides with the release from a halfway house of former Chicago Police Commander John Burge, who oversaw the secret torture of hundreds of prisoners in the 70s and 80s. Burge served 4.5 years for lying under oath about his crimes. One of the men Burge tortured was Shadid Mumin, who was convicted of murder on the basis of his forced confession, but was later found to be innocent. He recounted his ordeal in a statement aired on Democracy Now!
He handcuffed me real tight. As I said, he cut my circulation off. He went out of the room and stayed, I guess, for about an hour. And he came back and tried to talk to me. What could I tell him, you know, about the robber? I told him I couldn't tell you anything about the robber. I don't know about what you're talking about. And he said then that, oh, you're going to play tough. Say, you will tell us before you leave here what we want to know. Say, I've been known to get out of people's what I want. He got real upset and said, you will talk, you black mother. Said, I'll make you talk, keep you in here warm. So I still don't think so. In anger, he rushed to the typewriter and grabbed the plastic cover off there and just crammed it down over my head. And it's like he was a madman. This other officer helped me, but I was trying to get my arms out behind the chair, but I couldn't do anything. And I passed out. And like I said, he gave me a breath of air. And I came to conscious. And you ready to talk? And I said, I don't have anything to tell you still. So he did it again. The third time, out of the third time, that's when I told him, I said, I'll tell you whatever you want to know, man. Just don't do this no more.
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you will find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the Black Left. I'm Nellie Bailey, along with my co-host Glenn Ford. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network.
You've been listening to the Black Agenda Report on the Progressive Radio Network. Information for liberation.